Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's September 3rd after a nice long weekend. You guys, I'm sure, studied a lot. I got some emails saying, oh, what do I really have to study for the test coming up? And I just referred everybody to the study guide, right? It gives the pages and the chapter numbers, even though maybe I don't get to talk about something specifically in lecture. If it is a page in the reading assignment, or if it's a question at the end of the chapter, or the online questions, then yeah, all those are important for you to know. In particular, I didn't cover anything about tissues, but you guys spent a week or two in anatomy regarding tissues, talking about different tissues and things like that. So even though we're not going to take time to talk about it, that's a prerequisite for this class. So go back and just read over the information that's in your book, or go back to your anatomy book. It's very similar, just so that you have some understanding of what those tissues are, because that's how we understand a lot of disease processes, by looking at tissues, what happens to those cells, their layers, how the layers change or get disrupted. So that's really important to know histology and your tissues. So go back and take a look at those. Okay, here's the sign-in sheet for today. I think I updated it. I added students that added last week, dropped a couple students that weren't here. I'm not sure it's 100% correct. But if you don't see your name on there and you think you are registered, then you probably should see me, and we'll look officially in administration's records to see how you stand in the class, okay? Because there were a couple students, there was one student that we did give an ad code to that hasn't used it yet, and I don't really know if they intend to or not. That was you. Okay. Did you register? Oh, you got a, okay, you're working on that. Yeah, don't, then that ad code will still be good. If you use the ad code with a hold, then I think the ad code goes away. And if it's a problem, give me an email right away and I can send you another ad code. Okay, good. So you're not on that list, but go ahead, please sign in. Okay, excellent, excellent. Okay, I know your name, but I won't say it out loud because I'm recording, right? And I'm going to write up the web page to put these lectures on, and I'll start uploading the lectures so that you can download them. Okay. Okay, so we were talking about a number of things last time. Oh, I'll tell you what, let's look at the schedule real quick. So here's your syllabus, 241. Indeed, that's you guys. And so where are we? September 3rd, and we're going to have our second lecture on chemistry, or chemical composition of the body. And we're going to move out of some general chemistry and go into some things that look a lot like biochemistry, something a lot more relevant to your body than electrons and protons. But those electrons and protons are still nonetheless real important to how your physiology works, so it is important. And then next week, on Thursday, we have a chemistry lecture, and then we're going to move into chapter 6. So we're going to do 1, 2, and 6, then go back to 3. So, hooray, we're still on schedule. That's really nice. I'll put that away. We were talking about acids and bases. And so let's just review what an acid and a base is in the pH scale. Let's just talk about acids. I don't want to review bases necessarily, but what the heck is an acid? You should have on the tip of your tongue, what's a general way that you would explain to somebody, what is an acid? Maybe they have a little bit of a chemistry background, maybe a little bit. Okay, an acid is a molecule, okay, that's pH. You're talking about pH. I hear some numbers, and when I hear a number, I think of pH. But I just want to know what the concept of an acid is first. The concept of an acid is a molecule that does what? It gives off hydrogen ions, and what's another name for a hydrogen ion? Should I draw that on a, I'll draw that on the board. What's a hydrogen ion? So here is the chemical symbol for hydrogen. And it's got a plus one, so it's a cation, right? It's a monovalent cation. And if there's just a proton sitting in the nucleus all by itself, we also just call it a proton, right? So a hydrogen ion and proton are exactly the same thing. Okay. And an acid is a compound that will donate these things to a water solution. Will increase the hydrogen ion concentration in a water solution, or increase the proton concentration in a water solution. That's an acid. A base kind of goes the other way in terms of OH instead of protons. And the pH scale is just a measurement of the hydrogen ion concentration in water. Okay. Well, I want to talk to you about, I mentioned it a couple times, that the pH of a system is so important because it determines the shape of molecules, and if it determines the shape of molecules, ultimately, what does it determine? The function of these molecules. So I want to show you why the shape changes when the pH changes. Here is an acid that I showed you last time, phosphoric acid. All right, and if we look at this, I'm just going to give you a quick quiz, pop quiz. All right, what does this O stand for? Oxygen. Nice. What does this H stand for? And somebody said physiology is hard, right? And what's this P stand for? Phosphorus. Excellent. Okay, is this an atom or a molecule? It's a molecule because it's got all of these atoms put together. In particular, how many phosphorus atoms are in there? There's just one. Yeah, we don't write it down. And how many oxygens? Okay, there's four and three hydrogens. Okay, when we drop this in water, I said it's an acid. What is it going to give off? It's going to give off hydrogen ions, right? So it's first going to go to H2PO4. Got to turn that volume down. Plus a hydrogen ion. Okay, but this thing has to have the same electrical properties as this thing right here, right? And this thing right here is neutral. So if I have a proton over here, what has to happen here in order to make it electrically neutral? Those two, it's got to have a minus, right? Okay. And furthermore, this thing here can dissociate even a little bit further. It can become H1PO4. Now, what should we do with the electrical charge on this beast right here? Yeah, it's going to be 2 minus, right? Or I could go minus minus. So it has 2 minuses plus what? Another proton right here. Furthermore, since there's one proton here, that can even dissociate a little bit further. That can just become PO4 plus a hydrogen ion. All right, now what's the charge of this guy here going to be? It's going to be 3 negative. 1, 2, 3. Okay, or you could say 3 minus. All right, now what did we say about, opposite charges? They attract each other. Okay, so you see that this right here is changing its charge. So compared to here, it has no charge. Way over there, it's got 3 charges. As this thing happens, it will associate or dissociate from other molecules in solution. And when it's highly attracted, maybe when it's in this state, to a positive charge on a proton, it's going to glomp onto that proton at that location and to a protein. It's going to glomp onto a protein, okay, that has a positive charge, and it's going to start to bend that protein a little bit compared to over here. It will just ignore that protein's positive charge. All right, and so when it starts to bend the protein because it's more attracted to it, what's going to happen to the function of that protein? It's going to start to change, right? So here it changes a little bit, and over here it changes a little bit more, and then way over there it changes the shape drastically, right? But that's just one location. That happens maybe 1,000 or 100 times along the length of a protein. Okay, so pH determines the shape and then the physiology or the reactivity of chemicals inside your body. All right, so here's that list of acids and bases that we talked about. Here's that pH scale. Okay, and here is the funny thing about the pH scale. All right, we said that it is a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration in solution. I'm not going to erase that board right there. So I want to draw a beaker on the board. Actually, three beakers. So here's one beaker. Got water in it. Here's another beaker that has water in it, and a third beaker that has water in it. And I'm going to draw some hydrogen ions and some hydroxide anions in there, like so. All right, and if we have this proton and this hydrogen ion and we put them together, what do we get? We just get water, H2O, and here I put another hydroxide ion right here. Is this an acidic or basic solution? I only see 2 protons and I see 4 hydroxide anions. Is that acidic or basic? It's basic because there are more OHs than there are protons. That's going to be true in every particular case. All right, so we're going to say this is basic. More OHs than hydrogen. So what are we going to say? OH is what? Greater in concentration than the hydrogen ion concentration. All right, case number 3. Kind of see what I'm drawing right here? Beaker, you can conceptualize a beaker with these little molecules in there. Here's a hydrogen ion. Here's an OH. Here's another hydrogen ion. Here's an OH. Here's an OH. Here's another hydrogen ion. Now, what can you tell me about the concentrations of both the hydrogen ion and hydroxide anions in there? They're equal. And what's the pH? That's the only pH number that I can draw on the board, and you can tell me exactly what it is. It's exactly 7. Because the pH scale goes from 0 to 14, right smack in the middle, you have pH 7, right, which means that there are exactly the same number of hydrogen ions as hydroxide anions. And it just so happens you can also tell me what the concentration is in molarity, but I don't want to go into that right at the moment. Our third case, what we'd like to do for this third case over here. What can we do? Let's put a lot of hydrogen ions in here, like this, and maybe one OH group. All right, now what is this, what's the pH of this solution right here? Maybe not a number, but you could tell me if it's neutral or basic or acidic. Acidic, because it has a lot more hydrogen ions than OH groups, right? So this is acidic. This we said is basic, which means hydrogen ions, there's more hydrogen ions than OH. Another way of saying this in terms of pH, okay, the pH here is what? The pH here is going to be greater than 7. pH here is going to be equal to 7. The pH here, okay, is going to be less than 7. All right, and when you first look at that, it's not very intuitive, and it's complicated, and your thinking can get switched around. Just you got to remember, because of this equation right here, the pH equation, which you have to know how to use in your calculator, as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to acidity? As hydrogen ions increase, what happens to the acidity? Does it increase or decrease? The acidity increases, but what about the pH number? It goes the other way, right? It decreases. So you just got to be aware of that. So I wanted to mention that at least twice. Okay. Here are the molar concentrations of hydrogen ions. Here are the molar concentrations in hydroxide anions, depending on what the pH is. And you might notice there's a nice relationship between the pH and the exponent on the molar concentration of hydrogen ion. And that's just because of the pH equation. There's such a huge change in hydrogen ion concentration that we can't just use a linear scale. We have to use this exponential or logarithmic scale so that we can talk about pH and not carry the decimal point out to 14 places, right? I probably, maybe I have 3 boards. I could write it out in 14 places if I had to, but it would take maybe 3 boards to do that. But if we take the log of it, then I can just write it down as one simple number with 3 decimal places. It makes it easy. All right, so that's why we have this pH scale right here. And notice, as something becomes more acidic, the concentration of hydrogen ion increases, but the pH number does what? Decreases, right? Okay, and as the number gets smaller, it means it's more acidic. So 2 is more acidic than 3. 3 is more acidic than 4. And then finally, what about 7? The concentrations are exactly the same. 10 to the minus 7th, 10 to the minus 7th for both of those species. Okay. Okay, a buffer is a compound, a really nifty chemical compound, because there are a lot of things that we eat all the time, like Coca-Cola has a pH probably about 1, maybe 1.2, 1.3. We could Google it and find out what it is, Coca-Cola. So what does that make it? Neutral with a pH of 1? No. Is it basic? No. It is what? Acidic. Is it a little acidic or a lot acidic? That's about as acidic as you can get, right? Because you can only go to 0 and Coke is a pH of 1. And we said that pH, it changes how our body functions. So if we drink all of the acid because it's been really hot, maybe it went down to the 7-Eleven, got a big Slurpee, like 2.5 gallons of Coca-Cola with ice, and drank it all that acid, okay, how come we're still alive? How come the pH of our body just didn't drop drastically, okay, and that would be fatal if that were to happen? How come you can drink a Coke but still live through that? Or maybe eat vinegar on a salad in salad dressing, which is acetic acid, and still live through that. And the answer is because there are many chemicals in our body that act like buffers. And a buffer is a compound that maintains the pH of a solution, whether you add an acid to it or a base. It doesn't matter. Okay, the pH is going to stay the same. That's what we call a buffer. It doesn't mean that a buffer is going to maintain neutrality. It might maintain a basic pH. It might maintain a pH of 12, but if you add acid to that solution, the pH is going to stay 12. Or there are other kinds of buffers that maintain a pH of, let's say, 6, and if we add a base to it, the pH is still going to be 6. It won't change. It doesn't force it to 7. It will just maintain the pH. So we have buffers in our body, right? And our pH in blood is about 7.35. What is 7.35 in terms of understanding if acid or basic? A little bit basic, right? 7.35, a little bit greater than 7, a little bit basic. And if we drink all of that Coke that's very acidic, our pH is going to stay the same because we have buffers in our body. One of the important buffer systems is what we call the bicarbonate buffer system. So this is a pretty cool slide because we can see that here we have H2O, which is, you know this to be, water, and here we have CO2. We'll probably talk about that a little bit later today too. CO2, have you ever heard of that? Is that important for our biology, our physiology? Yeah, because that's what we excrete from our bodies, CO2. Okay. These two things can combine, right, to form this compound right here. This is carbonic acid. And at the pH that we exist at, this carbonic acid is going to dissociate into a hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. All right, so this is a bicarbonate anion. All right, so this is a nice buffer for the following reason. These arrows right here, how do you see these arrows? Are they pointing in one direction or two directions? Two directions, right? So things can go to the left, things can go to the right, and you might be wondering, well, how is it that we know which way this equation is going to work? Okay, and it has to do with the law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle, and it just says, okay, when the energy of these molecules is basically the same, as sum of this energy is equal to the energy over here, sum of the energy over here, it doesn't matter. These things can go right and left depending on the concentration of each of these species. So, for instance, if we have this solution in water and we add more water to it, thereby diluting out the CO2, okay, diluting out these chemicals right here, then that's going to force the reaction to the right. If we take water away, then the reaction is going to go to the left to rebuild some of that water. Furthermore, even more importantly, let's look at this end of the reaction. If we add hydrogen ions to solution, guess what's going to happen to those hydrogen ions? That's like adding acid to the solution. Guess what's going to happen because of Le Chatelier's principle? Those hydrogen ions are going to combine with bicarbonate, and what's going to happen to them? They're going to go away. They're not going to be in solution. And if the pH, I mean, if the hydrogen ion concentration in our solution inside our bodies doesn't change because of this buffer system, what happens to the pH if the hydrogen ion concentration doesn't change? Even though we add these things to it, it doesn't change, right, because it combines with bicarbonate to form this thing here. What happens to our pH? It stays the same. That's the cool thing about a buffer. Furthermore, then, this carbonic acid can dissociate to water and CO2, and we can actually breathe CO2 out of our bodies. And this system, okay, because we have a lot of bicarbonate in our blood, we have really alien blood. And our breath is very alien. Ever see the movie Aliens? They got a drop of blood on the spaceship, and it just ate the spaceship away. It was so acidic. Okay. Whenever we exhale, we're exhaling CO2 out of our body. Okay. And so that means this carbonic acid is going to be converted into CO2, and some of this acid right here is going to be converted into carbonic acid, right? When we breathe CO2 out of our bodies, what are we really breathing out of our body? We're really breathing acid out of our body. That's something pretty interesting. Because of this bicarbonate buffer system, right? So that's going to be something really important we're going to look at in guess what chapter? Respiratory chapter. Well, in all chapters, but especially the respiratory chapter, because that's what we're going to talk about, breathing and how that helps maintain pH and how it regulates pH in our bodies just because of this buffer system right here. Okay. And you should probably know the enzyme that catalyzes this reaction so that it happens really fast. We're going to talk about enzymes coming up in class, but not today. All right, so that's a buffer. The normal pH of blood, 7.35 to 7.45, and we said that the pH is, changes our physiology very sensitively, okay? That small change in pH can make big changes of how our body functions. For instance, we're at 7.35 right now, a little bit basic. And if we were to drink that Coke and change our pH, if we had no buffers and we drank all that acid, what would happen to the 7.35? Which way would it go? Aha. The acidity would go up because we drank all that acid, but what about the pH number? It goes down. Okay? And let's just say that we changed the pH in our blood from 7.35 down to 7.1, like within a minute or so. Does that seem like a big change to you? 7.35 to 7.1? I see some people shaking their head, yo, no, yes. Some people are shaking their head, no. Most people are saying, nah, that doesn't seem like much. Okay, but you know what? That would be lethal. That would be fatal. So that is a huge change in how our physiology works, which means what is so important in our body? The last thing we just talked about, which are buffers. That's why buffers are so important. Okay. All right, so we said your pH is maintained. Okay, if for some reason it goes loses homeostasis, acidosis is less than 7.35, right, because then it becomes more acidic. Alkalosis means that your body is becoming more basic, so then the pH becomes greater than 7.45. So this is what we call the normal range for maintaining homeostasis. And homeostasis is maintained in your body to a large degree by what kind of compounds? Buffers. Yeah, buffers, various chemical compounds. All proteins in our body are buffers as well. Have you ever heard of a protein? Yeah, what's a basic building block of a protein? Amino acid, probably a lot of people have heard that, right? And that forms the structure and it makes enzymes. All of those proteins are really important for our structure and function because of enzymes. All right, let's talk about some organic molecules. Before we start talking about some specific classes of organic molecules, right? An organic molecule, here's a nice strict definition, which I would like for you to know, are molecules, which means what? More than one atom, that contain a carbon. What's the chemical symbol for carbon? C. Covalently bound. Ooh, we should have reviewed this before we started. What's a covalent bond? It's a strong bond. And what are our electrons doing? Being shared. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Okay, so when you have a carbon covalently bound to a hydrogen atom. All right, so I'm going to draw some molecules on the board. So let's see, what about, so that's an organic molecule. So here is, what's that atom? Carbon. Here is oxygen, and how many are there? There's two, CO2. That's a very important biological molecule in us, right? Because we just said we have to excrete it from our body. It helps maintain pH in our body, real, real important. But is that an organic compound? No, because there's no hydrogen ion there. Right? This carbon is covalently bound to two oxygens, but not an organic compound. So your book kind of uses that term organic compound a little bit loosely, because there are important biological compounds that are not organic, like this one over here. Furthermore, there are millions of organic compounds that have played no role in your biochemistry whatsoever. Okay. So for instance, I can take another molecule with six of these carbons, right here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And each one of these little straight lines that I'm drawing represents a covalent bond. And we don't always have to draw this out like we see over here. And we're going to put a hydrogen on each one of these positions. Like this. And like this. All right? Continue all the way down the line. Is that an organic compound? Yeah, because here's a carbon, here's a hydrogen ion. Covalently bond, sharing electrons. This is benzene, okay, and that has no role in our biochemistry, unless you drink it or something, and then nobody has to worry about you ever again, because it's really bad for you to drink, right? That would be fatal. All right, so there are lots of organic compounds that play no role for us. Okay. Question, yeah. Organic compounds?
Yeah,
because of the way that physical chemistry sets the molecule up. We said that in the last lecture, this is really good to review. Covalent bonds can exist in two forms. It can be a polar or it can be a nonpolar. Okay? If it's a polar, that means that the atom that is associated with hydrogen is going to pull most of the electrons over. It's not really sharing. which means that you have that hydrogen ion sitting out by itself, which has a positive charge. That other atom has more negative charges, so one end of the molecule is positive, the other is negative, right? That's a polar covalent bond. Those kinds of molecules like to dissolve in water because water has that same nature. And what were those atoms that have a tendency to not share electrons equally? They were oxygen, because water, okay, number one, sulfur, phosphorus, and nitrogen. Okay, so those four. And carbon is not on that list. So carbon, hydrogen is not a polar covalent bond, that's a nonpolar. So this whole molecule is nonpolar. And if it's nonpolar, does it like to dissolve in water? It does not. It would like to dissolve in oil or something like that, some kind of lipid compound. And since we're mostly made out of water, this thing really won't dissolve in us and our body doesn't deal with it. But in organic chemistry, you would deal with such things, but in order to get it in solution, you'd have to use an organic solvent, like chloroform or something like that. Okay. Yeah, so that's a big deal with that. So a lot of times when people say organic molecule, they think of nonpolar molecules. That's not really a good definition. Sort of a good definition, but not really. Okay. For an organic chemist, that's probably a really good definition, but that's because they don't know so much about biochemistry. Okay, so do you see this last thing right here? Carbon has four electrons in its outer shell. Could you fill the shells of carbon out? Okay, you could look carbon up on the periodic table and know how many protons are inside the nucleus, and you would call that, what's that number called? The number of protons inside of a nucleus. Oh, I wish I had we used to have a periodic table here. That's called the atomic number. Those number of protons equals the number of electrons in all of the orbitals. Does anybody know how many protons are in carbon? There are six, okay? So the first orbital's got two, the second orbital's got four, but how many should that last orbital have? Instead of four, it should have eight. So it's looking for four electrons from somebody, right? So carbon can bond covalently to fill the shell with eight electrons. So if you find something that donates one electron, like this hydrogen right here, right? It needs one. Here you have a carbon. You need one hydrogen here, one hydrogen here, one hydrogen here, one hydrogen there, and then that forms a molecule. Okay. All right, so let's look at some organic molecules to get started. And indeed, does this look like a organic molecule right here? Yeah, I don't see any, it's got carbon and hydrogen, right? So this thing, this hexane, can actually bend back on itself and it can form a ring structure. We call that cyclohexane. Okay, and then furthermore, some of these hydrogen ions can drop off, and then there can be double bonds. You see two lines right here? That means that there, instead of two electrons being shared between these two carbon atoms, there are now four electrons. So you can have double bonds, you can have triple bonds to make covalent bonds even stronger or to fill up those shells. This right here is what we call benzene when it's in this cyclic form. Okay, so this carbon is a nice background for forming many biologically important molecules. These are all organic, but none of them are important for our biochemistry. But that's a nice building block to make some important biological molecules, because we can take this hydrogen ion and replace it with something else, maybe an OH group. So that OH group, instead of the hydrogen, we're going to call that a functional group. So that could be an SH, a sulfhydryl group, or a hydroxyl group, right? So that's what we call a functional group. And when we change the structure of hexane right here, instead of having an H, we put an OH right here. We're changing the structure. What are we changing then? The function of that molecule as well. Okay. All right, so substituting functional groups on this backbone makes our biochemistry work. And I do want you to see some of these functional groups. And even on the test, you should know this. Okay, a carbonyl group on that backbone, we have a double bond to an oxygen. You don't have two hydrogens, but you have a double bond to an oxygen. That's what we call a carbonyl group. Right, hydroxyl group is this OH instead of a hydrogen ion. Sulfhydryl group, we have an SH right here. And that helps change the nature of this molecule, because what can you tell me about this OH, this bond between this oxygen and hydrogen? It's a covalent bond, but what kind? Is it polar or nonpolar? It's polar. Now, this molecule likes to dissolve in water a little bit, at least this end of it. What about this sulfhydro group, the bond between the S and the H, between sulfur and hydrogen? That's a covalent bond, but what kind? It's polar as well. So this allows this end of the molecule to dissolve in water. Here is an amino group, right? NH2. And what can you tell me about the covalent bonds between these two hydrogens and nitrogen right here? They're polar as well, right? So now you're beginning to see some things that look a little bit more biological, because these kinds of functional groups allow these molecules to dissolve in water, right? And that just become organic compounds in organic chemistry labs. Here's another important group, a carboxyl group, a COOH, right? Here's a C, two O's, and an H. And this is another polar end to the molecule. Furthermore, this OH right here, this hydrogen, likes to jump off of this oxygen, okay, and become a free proton in solution. And what do we call a compound like this right here that can donate a proton to a water solution? That's an acid, right? So this carboxyl group is an acidic group on this organic compound. Right, so these compounds can be acidic or they could be basic compounds as well. And then here's another important one, a phosphate group. And phosphate forms polar covalent bonds. Furthermore, we have oxygens right here that make this end even more polar. And the other thing with this phosphate group, this hydrogen can jump off. So this is also an acidic group, right? And this one can jump off as well. All right, so a phosphate group is acidic, carboxyl group is acidic. So these carbonyl groups form ketones and aldehydes. Maybe in a hospital, you've heard of ketosis, okay? You've heard of acidosis probably, so they're due to some of these types of compounds. Alcohols have a OH group on them, and organic acids have what, a carboxyl group or a phosphate group on them. Okay, like lactic acid and acetic acid have this COOH group. So we're going to look at those functional, so what are all of these neat substitutions at this position on this carbon chain right here? These are what we call functional groups, and they change the function of these molecules. They could turn it into an acid or a base or change their chemistry, right? Just even their solubility in water is important. Okay. There are four important kinds of biological molecules that we're going to look at. There's other, some minor classes. And your book might call these organic compounds, and most of them are organic, but I'm going to call them biological because they play a really important role in our biology, our physiology. The first one is a carbohydrate. The second one we're going to look at is a protein. Third one we're going to look at is a lipid. And then the fourth one is a nucleic acid. And I think you have that list somewhere in these slides. All right, but the first one we're going to talk about is carbohydrate. And a carbohydrate looks a lot like, okay, a hexane or maybe a benzene molecule, because here is that carbon backbone and I see six carbons right there. But notice that we don't have hydrogen ions at every position. We have a different kind of functional group substituted at each one of these positions, which is what? A hydroxyl group. Okay, so if we look at each one of these positions right here, I see a carbon and I see an OH and another H. What do you call OH and another H? H what? H, how many H's there? Two? H2O. What do you know H2O to be? Water. Right, so when people were first investigating this particular kind of compound, they could measure how many carbons were in this molecule, and for every carbon, guess what they found? An H2O, a water molecule. So somebody said, oh, obviously this is a carbon hydrate, right? When you hydrate something, you put water in it. So this is a carbon hydrate, but that got to be a little bit too wordy, so now we just call these things carbohydrates, a little bit trendier kind of term, right? So a carbon hydrate is the same thing as a carbohydrate. It's a long carbon backbone with these OH groups, and so this bond between the oxygen and hydrogen here, that's a covalent bond. What kind of covalent bond? Polar, right? So here are a bunch of carbons, which are not really polar. They don't like to dissolve in water, but in each one of these positions, you see a polar covalent bond. So what can you tell me about sugar? Does sugar like to dissolve in water? Absolutely, because of all those polar covalent bonds, right? So that's why it's really nice to know something about that physical chemistry. All right, this backbone chain can form a cyclic ring like this, and this one right here is the conformation for glucose, and it can form this cyclic ring. It has that particular structure, just automatically makes that nice ring. This is what we call a monosaccharide. This is a building block for complex carbohydrates, or maybe we would call that a polysaccharide. Polysaccharide has many building blocks of these monosaccharides joined together. All right, here's another molecule, and it has six carbons. We call this a galactose. It looks very similar to glucose, but notice that the OH groups are located maybe on a little different location on the molecule. Instead of facing to the right, they face to the left in certain positions. Right, this is still what we call a monosaccharide, okay? But it's a little bit different. And guess what? The shape is a little bit different than this one. So what can you tell me about the function of these two molecules? The chain, they change a little bit, okay, because of the substitution is a little bit different. Here is another six-carbon monosaccharide, okay? But here's a carbonyl group instead of a carboxyl or aldehyde group over here. So again, the structure changes. It still has six carbons, but all these OHs right here still allows us to dissolve in water very nicely. This is what we call fructose. It forms a ring with five sides instead of six sides. So the structure is a little bit different. This is what we call fructose. Okay. I don't want you to be able to tell me that this is glucose and this is galactose and this is fructose on an exam, but I do want you to be able to tell me these are monosaccharides, and that each one of these monosaccharides have how many carbon atoms in them? They got six. So they're closely related to each other because of those six carbon atoms. That's going to be a pretty important fundamental principle of our biochemistry. All right, so carbohydrate is just a carbon hydrate always in this ratio, and what we've showed you here on this slide is this N here being six. So if there's six carbons, how many oxygens are there? There's going to be six, right, because you see that little N right there. We might find some other important carbohydrates that have five sugars on them. We're going to take a look at that. But here are some really important six-carbon sugars, and are these polysaccharides? These are monosaccharides, simple sugars. This is a nice simple sugar, carbohydrate. Okay, so we saw some monosaccharides. What the heck is a disaccharide? Yeah, it's when we have two monosaccharides joined together. That's a disaccharide. Okay, and here are some important ones. Sucrose, table sugar, it has a glucose and a fructose joined together. Lactose, or milk sugar, has glucose and galactose. Again, they're all six carbon sugars. And maltose, or malt sugar, has two glucoses joined together. These are all disaccharides. So, we're going to see how those things are put together. And we can put monosaccharides together to make those disaccharides, and even something larger than that, and those are what we're going to call polysaccharides, where there's many monosaccharides linked together. Could be hundreds, could be thousands, could be hundreds of thousands. I might be stretching the point a little bit, but it wouldn't surprise me. Okay, and those things that have a building block of glucose, only this right here, only glucose, hundreds or thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of these glucoses put together, okay, those things form starch in plants, or we call it glycogen in animals. And there's a little structural difference between starch and glycogen, but the basic building block is always going to be glucose, whether it's starch or glycogen. So, for instance, when you eat a potato, which is made up of, it's almost pure starch, what are you really eating? It's like a Snickers bar, right? It's just what? It's just glucose. That's what it is. Or pasta, right, which is wheat. And that's starch, that is just glucose. So if somebody has trouble maintaining their blood glucose concentration, maybe they have diabetes mellitus, can they eat as many French fries, potatoes, as they want all day long? No, because that would be the same thing as eating a candy bar all day long. That would be really unhelpful for them. All right, so it's important to know what the building blocks are for these kinds of biological molecules. Okay, so starch and glycogen, the basic building block is glucose. And glucose is an important energy molecule in our body. There are organelles in our body that can use glucose to make an important energy molecule. And what's your favorite energy molecule? You might say glucose, and I'd have a hard time arguing with you. But even more important than glucose is ATP, because that can be used by almost everything in your body. Everything in your body can't use glucose. It's got to be converted into ATP first. Okay? So, for instance, you might step off the plane with money in your pocket, but maybe you just came back from Holland, and they're guilders. You have guilders in your pocket, and you go to the grocery store, and you want to pay for groceries with guilders. Does that do you any good? No. What do you need? You need ATP or U.S. dollars in order to buy something, right? So that's what ATP is in your body. It's the currency that your cells use to run reactions. All right, so... Okay, polysaccharides like starch or glycogen allow organisms to store thousands of glucose molecules into one molecule. That's going to be, you're going to see that's really important when we get into some more physical chemistry. Because if you have 1,000 molecules in solution, that solution is going to behave a lot differently than if you have one. Even if that one molecule is made up of all those same 1,000 molecules, that's going to make cells swell up so much to where they can burst or remain the same shape. We call that osmolality of a solution. So making one big molecule out of it is a nice way of maintaining water balance inside of a cell. We're going to see that in a couple chapters coming up. That's what this statement is all about. Okay. So, but I know you're still considering, well, how do we make a disaccharide from monosaccharides? Okay, so let's clear that up right now. All right, formation of disaccharides. Here we have a glucose molecule just sitting all by itself and another glucose molecule sitting all by itself. And we see that there are a bunch of what? Hydroxide groups all over these molecules. And we also know that water is H2O, very similar to what we're looking at right here. So if we put these two glucoses together just in this orientation and they bump right here, all right, we've got an OH and an OH. What can happen is that this hydrogen and this OH group can join together to form a water molecule. They come off the two monosaccharides, but that's now going to form a covalent bond between these two monosaccharides to make a maltose. Right, and so you have a maltose, and what other molecule is made when this disaccharide is produced? You got water. So we call that a dehydration synthesis reaction. Dehydration synthesis, right? Because we're making a new molecule. We're taking water out. That's the dehydration part of it. And sometimes we call that condensation. If you ever have a glass that's really, really cold, it has ice cubes on it, and it's kind of humid outside, what happens to the outside of that glass? Water condenses out. Water just comes right out of the air, right? Forms these little beads and runs down the side of the glass. That's condensation. So that's where this term comes from. When water appears, seemingly out of nowhere, right, that's what we call a condensation reaction. So condensation or dehydration synthesis is a way of making a polysaccharide from building blocks, right? A polysaccharide from these two monosaccharides. Furthermore, we can take a glucose or a fructose. They're very similar. They have hydroxide groups on them. And if water comes out, okay, now you have glucose and fructose joined together, and you know that to be what kind of sugar? Generally a disaccharide. Specifically, it is sucrose. Okay? So sucrose, maltose. What was another one that we talked about? Lactose. What kind of reaction would your body use to make a lactose molecule? It's called a dehydration synthesis reaction, right? So all of these sugars are joined together and your body didn't have to come up and invent new kinds of chemical reactions. It's the same kind of reaction that's used over and over and over again to make more complex sugars. Let me look at the next slide. Okay. Well, we also have something else. We just saw that we can join monosaccharides to make this disaccharide and even a polysaccharide. But the reverse reaction is important as well, because when your body runs low on glucose in the blood, you become hypoglycemic. There's glycogen in your liver. Your liver can break glycogen down bit by bit and put that glucose in your blood, thereby maintaining blood glucose concentration. So the reverse of that reaction is just as important. So in your liver, here is a polysaccharide of glucose. Here it's just shown as a disaccharide. And it can be broken down. You can put a little reverse arrow right here. Right? So cross that little arrow off. Put a reverse arrow right here. Right? But in order to break down maltose, you need another molecule. Namely, you need water. So So water is split apart. It's inserted right into this bridge between the two glucoses, and now the glucose is split apart, and they're back to their original structure of having two OH groups right here, existing as two monosaccharides. This is what we call a hydrolysis reaction. Right, hydrolysis. So hydrolysis, what does lysis mean?
Breaking apart.
Yeah, breaking apart. Hydro means water. It's a breaking apart of water and breaking apart polysaccharides into simple sugars or their building blocks. The same thing for sucrose. We can break sucrose down into glucose and fructose in our bodies by what kind of reaction?
Hydrolysis
reaction. So I do want for you to have that on the tip of your tongue. What would you use to make a disaccharide? What kind of reaction would your body use to make a disaccharide? Condensation or dehydration synthesis. When you're going from a disaccharide to two monosaccharides, your body would use hydrolysis reaction. Okay, so same thing over and over and over again. Doesn't matter what the basic building blocks are. All right, so that's for carbohydrates, and you can see carbohydrates are very soluble in water, and they can be joined together to make more complicated kinds of large biomolecules. Let's change the topic a little bit to lipids. Lipids are insoluble in water, okay, because water is a polar solvent, which means a lipid is nonpolar. Okay, and because it's nonpolar, indeed you're right, it is hydrophobic. Hydrophobic and polar kind of mean the same thing. One is a little bit more descriptive maybe than the other. All right, so lipids consist primarily of hydrocarbon chains and rings. They don't have much in the way of substituting hydroxide groups, sulfhydro groups, phosphate groups, or nitrogen groups on them, except in a couple really important exceptions, right? There's exceptions to every rule. But if it's a pure lipid that's not soluble in water, then it's just a hydrocarbon chain. And we can look at a nice hydrocarbon chain. Let's look at this column right here. I see a long carbon backbone, and there are no special functional groups on any of these carbons. It's just a hydrogen atom. So this end of the atom is what? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic because I just see nonpolar covalent bonds. There's no oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, or phosphorus, right? So this end of the molecule does not like to dissolve in water whatsoever. This is what we call a fatty acid. And why do we call it a fatty acid? Because at the end, only on one end of this molecule, I see a carboxyl group. That's a functional group, right? And this end of the molecule makes a fatty acid a little bit soluble in water, because that's the polar end of it. Okay. This fatty acid, and as a matter of fact, two other fatty acids can join this compound right here. And how many carbons do you see in this backbone? I see three, right? And this is what we call glycerol. That's going to be maybe your second favorite molecule in here, okay, glycerol. And I can see an OH group on each of these carbons and then hydrogens in the other positions. That's an important metabolic intermediate, but it also plays an important role in forming a triglyceride. Probably you've all had a blood test where they looked at your triglycerides in your blood, or maybe family member for sure. Okay, you probably run into that term triglyceride. Well, what the heck is it? Okay, it's three fatty acids that have been joined together with a glycerol molecule, and you see highlighted in yellow. What do you see highlighted in yellow right here? An H. 2O, right? This fatty acid can join to this carbon atom right here, so we have a nice covalent bond. What kind of reaction do we call that? Dehydration synthesis reaction, just like for carbohydrates. Didn't have to invent anything new or fancy, same reaction. Okay, but not just one time, how many times? Three times with three fatty acids. So now we have three fatty acids joined to this glycerol molecule, and that forms a triglyceride. So a triglyceride is a nice storage form for fatty acids. As a matter of fact, three of them in your body. Okay, and if it joins, if it makes these three ester bonds right here, what else does it make? Three waters, because it's a dehydration synthesis reaction. And just like you can break a complex sugar down into its building blocks, how would you take a disaccharide and break it down into two monosaccharides? Hydrolysis reaction, guess what? Your body uses the same reaction right here, a hydrolysis reaction. It would take three waters, okay, to chop off these three fatty acids to where you have those three fatty acids now in solution and one glycerol molecule. Okay, is that what I have on the next slide? Nope, I don't. Good. Well, I'm glad I mentioned it. So this arrow right here, we see it going in one direction for the condensation or dehydration synthesis, but remember, it can go in the reverse direction, and that's what we call hydrolysis reaction when your body needs fatty acids for some reason. Maybe making ATP would be a good reason. All right, what about this glycerol molecule? Let's analyze glycerol. Is it polar or nonpolar? What are the four atoms that are necessary to make a polar covalent bond? Oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, and phosphorus. Do you see an oxygen, phosphorus, sulfur, or nitrogen bound to a hydrogen atom here? Yes, I see three of them. So glycerol is really, really happy to dissolve in water because of all those polar covalent bonds that I see. Each one of these highlighted in yellow is a polar covalent bond. So glycerol dissolves in water very easily. Okay. Might be interested to know something about fatty acids. They're extremely long. They could have 18 or 20 or 22 carbon atoms joined together. They will have different names when they have a different number of carbon atoms. In a biochemistry class, you'll probably memorize a whole bunch of them. In this class, you don't have to memorize any names of fatty acids, but you should kind of know what their structure is, right? A fatty acid, because here's the fatty end of the molecule, right? I just see nonpolar covalent bonds, and then the other end of the molecule is a acidic group, a carboxyl group. So hence, it is a fatty acid. That's how it got its name. All right. This one right here, we see only single bonds between every carbon in this backbone. The fatty acid down below it has a little bit different name. It has more carbon atoms, but also it has some double bonds between carbon atoms. Right. So the top one, where every carbon is completely filled up with hydrogens, we call that a saturated fatty acid. Where there are double bonds, right? You could actually put a hydrogen here if you were to break this double bond, make it a single bond. This is what we call an unsaturated fatty acid. And since you have these double bonds right here, an unsaturated fatty acid has a different kind of shape. It has a lot more bends and wiggles to it. And when you change the shape of a molecule, what are you going to change? The function. So the function of unsaturated fatty acids is different than saturated fatty acids inside your body, basically because of shape. And if you can take this linoleic acid and convert it all to just a saturated fatty acid that's going to change shape, maybe from all straight to crooked like that, back to straight, back to crooked, what does that remind you of? Crooked, straight. Crooked, straight. What could that be used for? Crooked, straight, crooked, straight, crooked, straight. It can be used as a switch to turn things on and off in your body just by changing the shape of things. That's what's so cool. Okay. All right. I think you can see that. Maybe a little obscure, but nonetheless important. Right? It can be used as a simple switch. That's pretty cool. All right. Here is a class of lipids, okay, that we call phospholipids because they contain a phosphorus functional group on there. And let's take a look at that phosphorus. It's a little bit more complicated than phosphorus. Here is C1, C2, I see three carbons right here. And what does that remind you of when you see these three carbons? How about glucose? No, it doesn't look like glucose. It looks like, yeah, look through it, you can see glycerol. Okay, because here I see an O and an O, and I see an O over here. That's a glycerol for sure. In the first two positions, I see that it has been condensed with a fatty acid, so I see two fatty acids. This is the organic or hydrophobic part of the molecule. It does not like to dissolve in water. But what about this third carbon right here, stuck on the end? I see a phosphate group, and I see a minus charge. So that means that this minus charge likes to bind up hydrogen bond with the positive end of a water molecule, namely the hydrogen end of a water molecule. Okay. Then I see a nitrogen here as well, and there's a positive charge on it, so that likes to dissolve in water. So this is what we call the hydrophilic end of the molecule. Here's the hydrophobic end of the molecule. So we're getting a little bit complicated right now because here's a molecule that can be happy in water or oil. Okay. So That is really important because of the chemistry right here. And we can illustrate this complicated form with this nice large head group right here. This is the polar or hydrophilic part of the molecule. Here is these little tails right here represent the nonpolar or hydrophobic part of the molecule. So this end right here likes to do what with water? Dissolve or get separated from it? This one here, polar, hydrophilic. This is the part that likes to dissolve in water. This is the part over here, hydrophobic, that wants nothing to do with water. Okay? It has two opposite ends, and as a matter of fact, this might even be your favorite molecule for the following reason. Let's play around with this molecule a little bit. Okay, so I'm going to go to the board. Hopefully you guys in the back can see the board. I'll pick a nice dark marker so that you can see where's the nice dark marker at. This one is pretty good. Okay, so we're talking about this molecule right here. Okay, that's a large drawing of it, and so you should be able to tell me what that is. What is that? That's a phospholipid, because here's the phosphate group, here's the lipid part, right? Phosphate group, lipid part, this is what we call the head, this is what we call the tail. All right, let's, holiday weekend, probably had a picnic outside. You set up a nice picnic table and you had a salad, and then out of the refrigerator you got one of these bottles right here. Here's the top, there's fluid inside this bottle. Okay, and then furthermore, here's another little layer right here, and there's two separate compartments to what's inside this bottle. What am I talking about? Like salad dressing, right? You got this bottle out of the refrigerator and salad dressing, and you know there's two compartments right here. And what kind of solvent do you see at the bottom? You see water. And what's on top? Oil. Okay? So if you take this bottle and pour it on your salad, what are you going to get? You're just going to get oil. And most people don't really like that. Okay? They like to have the water part mixed in with the oil, because here you have all the spices and stuff that tastes good. Right? So you don't pour it on your salad like that. What do? You shake it up. Right? And you get little bubbles of oil and water together, so they're all mixed up, and then you pour it on your salad. Okay. Now, so you're going to put it back in the refrigerator, all shook up, right? So everything's all mixed together, and what's going to happen to it? It's going to go like that. Somebody said separate. I like that term. It's going to separate. And is that a special process? Do you have little demons in there running around grabbing oil, throwing it on the top, grabbing water, throwing it on the bottom, or does it happen? It just happens automatically because of the physical chemistry of these molecules, hydrophilic, hydrophobic, right? Okay, so we got this salad dressing bottle. We're going to take this molecule right here and throw it in there. And it's going to wander around, but is it going to go to a particular location in this salad dressing bottle? Can some people see what's going on? Well, this is the hydrophilic region. It's going to want to go to the water. Here's the hydrophobic region. It's going to want to go to the water, to the oil. So we drop that in there, it goes kaplunk, it splashes, and then immediately, right, it's going to end up just like that. Did we have a little demon in there running around putting that molecule right there? No. It just happened automatically, sort of by magic, but now you can understand why that happens. Okay. All right. Well, let's take another bottle like this, and we only put water. Only water, 100% water. Okay. And then we take some phospholipid, and let's dump maybe 10 of them in there. Not just one, but let's put 10 of them in there. And where are they going to go? Where are these 10 molecules going to go? They're going to go to the top, to the bottom, or someplace like this. Okay, but there's no oil. So there's really nothing drawing them to the top. You know what's going to happen? What is the hydrophilic end of the molecule? The head group. Okay, so here we have the hydrophilic part. That's going to be around water. And the lipid tails are going to stick in like that. And then there's going to be another phospholipid with the hydrophobic part sticking like that. And another one, 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 with all the hydrophobic tails sticking to the center, right? And it's going to form that circle right there with the hydrophilic part sticking out, the hydrophobic parts all sticking in, not just in two dimensions, but all the way around. It's going to form a sphere, okay? And when you have that sphere, what the heck does that look like? that looks like a lava lamp, but in terms of, you're right, it looks like a lava, and a lava lamp might actually have something that just looks a lot like that, molecules that look like that. But in biological terms, what I see right there is a cell. Okay, that looks a lot like a cell to me. And how did this cell form? A little demon putting it all together? Automatically. Okay, just automatically. Okay, furthermore, we could put more and more phospholipids in there, and what's going to happen is that it's going to form, okay, something that looks like this. All right, something like that. It's going to have two layers. It's going to have all these little fatty groups pointing to the center of this layer, like so. All right. Like that. Okay, and what does that look like to you? Looks like a really good drawing. Okay, put your cameras away. But this now, to me, in terms of biology, looks like a membrane. Okay, so you can have water here, and you can have water over here, and here's the separation between these two water compartments. That's a membrane. So membranes self-assemble because their basic building block is what? A phospholipid. Don't need anything special to happen. You just need to have the right shape of the molecule with the right properties. And then, you know, extend that out. And in anatomy, you saw, what's the simplest way to talk about a cell membrane? The phospholipid bilayer, right? Here's one layer, here's the other one. Phospholipid bilayer. So the basic building block of membranes in your body are phospholipids. It makes these bilayers. Well, of course, we got to get beyond that. Membranes are just more important than just a barrier between two water compartments. Okay, what's a more sophisticated way to talk about a membrane? Not just phospholipid bilayer, but it's called the fluid mosaic model. Dissolved within the membrane can be other proteins, maybe other sugar molecules, and when we change the structure of this membrane, what are we changing? We're going to change the function drastically of that membrane as well. Okay? All right, so we'll look at membranes, especially when we get to neuroanatomy. That's going to be really important. All right, so I do want you to be able to recognize this figure right here as a phospholipid. I do want you to recognize this thing as a phospholipid. I don't think it's important for you to draw it out. You could draw this out. This is not too hard to draw out. Okay, but I want your eye to recognize these shapes as being a phospholipid. No, this is the polar end because of all these charges, because of phosphorus and nitrogen. Here's the nonpolar end. Okay, we'll do some practicing identifying these things because I have a little flash quiz. Some of you have worked with some of my flash quizzes in anatomy, like the histology flash quiz. Maybe if we have time today, we can look at some of these things. All right, so here you have a bunch of phospholipids, basically just what I drew on the board. Put a bunch of these together, it forms this sphere that we call a micelle with the hydrophobic parts on the inside, the hydrophilic on the outside, and you can see water can form these hydration shells around the phosphate groups on a phospholipid. So sometimes these phospholipids can act as surfactants or detergents. A detergent is basically a molecule that one end can dissolve in water and the other end dissolves in oil, and that's what you use to get what out of your clothes? Like oil that's in your clothes so that it can dissolve in water. That's what dissolves oil on your clothes. Okay, another class of lipids, another type of lipid is what we call a steroid. These are important hormones or signaling molecules, and this right here represents a ring, and I see it. There's a carbon, number one carbon here, two, three, four, five, six carbons, and we haven't drawn in all the hydrogen ions around this particular structure, but here's a six ring, here's a six ring, here's a six, here's a five carbon ring. All right. I do want you to recognize all of these right here as steroids. You don't have to know their name. Here is estradiol that can run around with another name called estrogen. Probably you've heard of estrogen as being an important female sex hormone. Testosterone is an important male sex hormone. Cortisol, that's an important for helping regulate your immune response and other kinds of things. These are important ones that you've probably heard of before. They all come from this thing right here, which is what? Can you see that? Yeah. Cholesterol. Good. Some of you are close enough to read that. It would be nice if you could read that. That's cholesterol. All right, and what have you known about cholesterol? What have you heard about cholesterol lately? Good or bad?
Good.
Good bad. Aha, good or bad. That's right. It could be good or bad. It could be good because you build these sex hormones out of it. And everybody wants the right levels of sex hormones, right? That's all there's to it. Or mostly everybody. Okay. But if you have too much cholesterol, that can cause cardiovascular disease, right? So you got to have the right amount. So what I want you to remember is that all these important signaling compounds like cortisol, testosterone, estradiol, and all of the steroids inside your body, we're going to look at a number of them, right, can be derived from cholesterol because they basically have what? The same shape. It kind of looks like a staircase to me, right? There's a step here and a step here and a step here, right? Step, 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 step. So I can see that pretty easily. And then these different hormones have just a little bit different substitution, different functional groups in different locations. And since we're changing the structure of cortisol, changing it to look like testosterone, what about the function? It's going to change as well, right? So changing how these molecules, the structure of these molecules, change what their function is inside the cell. Another kind of lipid that's really important is a long hydrocarbon chain with maybe a couple substitutions along the way, not very many. Here's a carboxyl group. What do you call a molecule with a long hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl group on it? What's that carboxyl group? That's an acid group, right? That's an acid. So that's really this is the acid part. Here is the fatty part. So this is a fatty acid, but it looks a little bit different than what you were looking at previously. Because why? It's been folded with this nice hairpin turn right here, right? These are what we call prostaglandins. So you can imagine, where do prostaglandins come from? They're made from fatty acids inside your body. Okay, they're just a little modified fatty acid. And prostaglandins are important signaling compounds, just as important or more important than sex hormones, for instance. All right, and we're going to look at some prostaglandins in here. Not too many. There are many, many, many important prostaglandins. We'll get to talk about a couple of them. They serve regulatory functions, right? They act like hormones. Okay. All right, so that's it for lipids. What have we talked about so far? What are the two classes of biological molecules that we talked about so far? Carbohydrates and lipids. What kind of reaction would you use to make a complex sugar or a complex lipid, like maybe a triglyceride? What kind of reactions would you use to make a complex dehydration synthesis? That's right. Same reaction. Doesn't matter. What would you use to break a complex molecule down into its building blocks? Hydrolysis reaction. Same one. Okay. And for hydrolysis reaction, what else do you need? You need water. Yeah, you got to break water apart, right? Okay. The third of four types of biological molecules we're going to look at is a protein. And guess what? I think you know a lot about proteins already. You already know it's a building block. Maybe you don't know what it looks like just yet, but you know it is an amino acid, which means the acid part comes from carboxyl group. The amino part of that word comes from that amino functional group that you're going to have to know about for the test. So here are some amino acids. I see five amino acids right here. All amino acids have the structure that we see on the top line. And so I see two carbon atoms. One carbon has a carboxyl group. This middle carbon atom right here has an amino group on the other side. And then there is a hydrogen pointing down, and then there's an R pointing up. That R just stands for a variable functional group. It could be a whole bunch of different things. And if it changes, we change the name of that amino acid. It's still an amino acid because why? It has a carboxyl group and it has an amino group. And hence we call it an amino acid because it has those functional groups right there. And it's always going to have this kind of structure. This is sometimes what we call the alpha carbon or central carbon in an amino acid. Sometimes we can put like a bunch of CH3 groups, like I see over here, right? It's still what? An amino acid, but it has this nice nonpolar group on it. So this amino acid, or this end of it, is nonpolar. Here's tyrosine that has this nice ring on top of it. Again, this one right here is basically nonpolar. It's tyrosine. It's a different structure than valine, and it has then a different function inside your body. Right, and here we can see arginine has these NH groups on it that makes it basic. Here is aspartic acid that has a carboxyl group in this location, which makes this even a more acidic kind of amino acid. And then here's cysteine that has an SH group on it. And what does this S here, what does that do to this molecule? It means this SH, well, that's a covalent bond, but what kind of covalent bond is that? That's polar covalent bond. So this can actually help this molecule dissolve in water. Okay? It also makes it pretty reactive. We're going to see how that's important in just a little bit. So this R group can just form different kinds of structures on this basic structure of what an amino acid is. The other thing that I notice about an amino acid that's sort of interesting, I see an OH group here, and I see an H over here. What does that look like to you? H2O, right? So instead of having one amino acid, we can put two in the line right next to each other. What do we got? We got an OH, and then that H comes over here. It looks like we can put amino acids together with a dehydration synthesis reaction, just like you would use for lipid triglyceride synthesis or a polysaccharide synthesis. And indeed, look at this right here. Here I see 1, 2, 3, 4. What are these things? Amino acid, right? And if we put them together just in this way, we have what? A water molecule here, and here. So here I see 4 amino acids. They can be joined together with, we call a peptide bond, with a dehydration synthesis reaction. 3 waters are going to come out. And now instead of having amino acids, we have a protein or polypeptide, a really small protein, only 4 amino acids. This right here is a really strong covalent bond. Even though it's just one, only one pair of electrons is being what? What are electrons doing here? Being shared. Yep, electrons are being shared right here, but that's a very strong covalent bond, which means these bonds are very stable. It's hard to break a protein apart. But nonetheless, you can go in the reverse direction, right? And in the reverse direction, how many waters would you need? You would need 3. We would call that a hydrolysis reaction. Hydrolysis reactions can take place, but what can you tell me about the pH of your stomach? Oh, it's alien. It's like pH 1, right? It's totally different than the rest of your body. That's the kind of pH environment is necessary to help break some of these bonds down. And your small intestine, what's the pH of your small intestine? Does it go back to neutral? Is it 7? No, it goes the other way. It's very basic, which again is a very rough environment, but it's necessary to break these peptide bonds down. Okay, this is going to be another extra credit assignment drawing in lab next week because I didn't have time to get it out over the weekend. I forgot. Okay, so I do want you to be able to draw out this line right here, going to this line here, and don't forget what? This water. And label it as a, going in this direction would be a dehydration synthesis reaction, making a nice complex molecule with the same building block over and over and over again. And maybe you could think of that as a chain with a different links in a chain. And when you make a molecule with the same building blocks over and over and over again, just forget that these R groups could be different, right? But let's just say that it's the same building block over and over and over again. That's what we call a polymer. Polymer is a long molecule with the same kind of building block over and over and over and over again, making something way more complicated, but the reaction that's used to make a polymer is the same one over and over again. Doesn't matter if it's a carbohydrate, doesn't matter if it's a sugar, doesn't matter if it's a protein, and it doesn't matter if it's the next type of compound that we're going to look at, which is what? Nucleic acid. Right? Nucleic acids are made by dehydration synthesis reactions again. But before we get to that, what else do we got to finish with peptides? A polypeptide has less than 100 amino acids joined together. A protein has, generally speaking, more than 100. Okay, protein structure. Oh, here are some good things about proteins that we have to talk about. All right, so here I see a carbon with an amino group over here. Carboxyl group is going to be here. So here is a carbon with amino. Here's that same carbon with a carboxyl group. So this is one amino acid. Here is the second amino acid. Here's the third amino acid. So there are 3 amino acids joined together. And it's just a nice straight line when we put these things together. That's a nice basic concept. Right? And this amino acid here, amino acid 3, could be what, a glycine or valine, tyrosine, or any of 20 commonly occurring amino acids. Right? It could be any of those 20. And in amino acid location number 2, it could be a different one of each of those 20 different amino acids, or it could be the same one. Okay, and here's the third one. So depending on the amino acid that's put in each location right here, you're actually spelling out different words with different letters in each position, right? So you know a word to have like one letter in the first position, it's got another letter in the third, and another letter in the fourth position, I forgot the second one, right? And that spells out a word. When you change the sequence of amino acids, you're spelling out what? A new word, a different word. You're changing the structure of that protein, you're going to change the function of it. All right, so this right here, the spelling of a protein or the sequence of amino acids is what we call the primary structure of its of a protein. Okay? That's the simplest way to think of a protein. Just like if you know how to spell a word, the simplest thing about that word is know the spelling of it. Okay? But you might not know what that word means. Right? You have to know some more things about it. So we got to know some more things about a protein. We first start with the primary structure. But because of the primary structure and the functional groups on these locations right here, let's just say that all of these groups right here are hydrophobic. They don't want to be with water. Maybe they'll point to the inside, right? And then that sequence of amino acids is going to form this structure right here that we call an alpha helix. So this is a specific structure. We call this the secondary structure of a protein. How it bends. What is some short-term bending within the molecule? That is the secondary structure. And the secondary structure is defined by what? It's determined by, guess what? The primary structure. If we change the primary structure, what's going to happen to the secondary structure? It's going to change as well. Another kind of common kind of secondary structure is what we call a beta pleated sheet. It looks more like an accordion. It's just kind of a zigzag pattern back and forth. But that zigzag pattern is a lot different than that coil pattern, so it's going to have different kinds of properties inside our body. So here is secondary structure determined by primary structure. And depending on what kind of secondary structure a protein has, there might be a number of locations where there are alpha helices. Right, and then some regions right here that are really bendy because there's not an alpha helix right there. Okay, the overall protein made up of hundreds of amino acids might bend into this shape right here. And so this is what we call the conformation of the protein. It has a certain three-dimensional shape, not just in one little region, but overall it's going to look like this. And this is what we call the tertiary structure of a protein. Because of regions of alpha helices, beta pleated sheets, and other regions that like to bend up on each other. Okay. And the tertiary structure is determined by what? It's going to be determined by the secondary structure. And the secondary structure is determined by the primary structure. Secondary structure is determined by the primary structure. So if we change the primary structure, what's likely to happen? A change in the tertiary structure, which means the function of that protein is going to drastically change. This particular one is built up a certain way. It has the right amino acid sequence, has the correct then secondary sequence, that has the right tertiary sequence. So there is a little space right here that can hold another important organic compound, and that's called a heme group. And that heme group can also bind an iron atom. And because of that, this protein loves to grab oxygen and can hold on oxygen. And so red blood cells are loaded with these kinds of proteins, not just one at a time, but there's actually going to be four of these heme groups. And each of those heme groups can bind one oxygen, so one molecule can bind four oxygens, and that's what our body uses to deliver oxygen from one place to another. And when you put four of these proteins together, that's called hemoglobin, with this group with an iron atom right here. Okay. But this protein has to have just the right shape in order to bind this heme group. All right. And what could happen, right, if we change the sequence of amino acids right here? If we change the primary structure of hemoglobin, the secondary structure is going to change, and the tertiary structure is going to change, and then maybe oxygen can't bind because this heme group won't be in the right location. So you have hemoglobin that can't carry oxygen in the body. A really good example of this is sickle cell anemia, where there is a change in just one location in a polypeptide that has hundreds of amino acids, one little change in one amino acid, and those heme groups can't carry oxygen, and even more importantly, it changes the whole shape of a red blood cell from a nice round shape to a sickle shape that has a lot of points on it, and when that cell goes to have all those points on it, it can't flow through a blood vessel. It gets trapped. Right? And that causes a lot of disease in people that have sickle cell anemia. We'll talk some more about that. Okay, so small changes in the structure, small changes in the primary structure of a protein can mean what? The difference between life and death, or a normal life or a miserable life. Right? So small changes in structure can make huge changes in how physiology works. Okay, well, let me look at the next slide. All right, so we're still going to be talking about this one, but let's zoom into one little region of that big molecule. And so here I see hundreds of amino acids joined together by what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction. So now we have a nice long protein, and we see some folding. All right, and here I see an amino acid that has an SH group on it. Here's another amino acid at a really distant location that has an S group on it. That would be two cysteine amino acids here and here, but these sulfur groups can form a really nice covalent bond called a disulfide bond. That's covalent. And what can you tell me about covalent bonds? Weak or strong? Strong. So here is a strong bridge between these two locations on this protein, and that stabilizes the protein. Okay, and it gives this protein a certain kind of bend right there, and it's difficult to break. That's a very stable way of making this protein go into this kind of shape, right, due to this disulfide bond. That's a strong bond. Here are a couple different amino acids that can form a hydrogen bond between these two groups. And what kind of bond is that? That's a lot weaker, right? So it stabilizes the protein into this shape right here, but it's a weak bond, so that if we change the temperature and the molecule starts to wiggle around a lot, or the pH, for instance, or the salt concentration, it can break this bond, and then the protein will have a tendency to change shape when that happens. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's slide. That is a little misleading, because if it's a disulfide bond, that's highly stabilizing. That's very stabilizing. The remaining three are very weak, and it can only stabilize it a little bit. Hydrogen bond is weak. Ionic bonds are pretty weak, right? Like if we change the pH of this thing, then that's going to disrupt this ionic bond. And then what's the weakest force that we talked about? Hardly talked about it at all. Van der Waals forces between nonpolar groups on distant amino acids. And since water doesn't want to have anything to do with this region, these are two regions on the protein that will want to glomp together because they're nonpolar regions. But that's a very weak kind of association. So you got a very weak one, right? Van der Waals, sort of a weak one, hydrogen bond, maybe not so weak ionic bond, and then very strong bonds that really can stabilize the conformation of a protein. Okay, this disulfide bond. Okay, going back to the other slide. So we can change the shape of this amino acid by changing the pH or salt concentration, because it's going to interact with these ionic bonds. Temperature. The temperature is really a measurement of how things are moving in solution. As the temperature increases, the motion of molecules increase. Instead of just a little bit, they start bouncing around very radically. And when things start to wiggle and twist and bend, as the temperature increases, it can actually break some of these bonds, especially the weak ones. Probably not this sulfhydryl bond right here, but these others, hydrogen, van der Waals, and ionic bonds. Okay. And when it changes the shape of that protein, it's going to change its function. When the shape of a protein is changed due to temperature, changes in pH, or salt, we call that denaturation. And denaturation is usually an irreversible process. So let's think of one of your maybe favorite kinds of proteins, like hamburger. So you have some raw hamburger. Does it look different than a cooked hamburger? Yeah, a lot different, because the cooked hamburger is all denatured proteins. The raw is just proteins in their what we call native or natural configuration. looks totally different. Okay, but for sure you all recognize that's an irreversible process, right? Because maybe I'm cooking a hamburger on my barbecue tonight, I get it cooked just perfectly and I'm going to sit down and enjoy a nice hamburger, but I get a call on my cell phone from my friend saying, oh, a pool table just opened up and we got three people, we need a fourth person, would you please come down and shoot pool with us? And so what am I going to say? No, I got to stay home and eat my hamburger, or am I going to go shoot pool? Obviously, I'm going to go shoot pool, right? So I take that hamburger that's perfectly cooked, and I put it in the refrigerator. That's just how it started, right? In the refrigerator, cold. Now, I got a cold hamburger. Is it going to look different than the raw hamburger? Yes, same temperature, but what has happened? It's been denatured. It can't go back to look like that raw protein anymore, the uncooked protein, because the shape has changed so radically, it can't get back to the conformation that it had. And usually a protein can only get this configuration as it's being made, one amino acid at a time. As amino acid is added to it, it forms a little bend. And then when that amino acid is added again, it forms the right kind of conformation. That's the only way it can really get the right shape. It can't ever be put back into the right shape. I only know one exception to that rule. So think about that exception to that rule of denaturation. Okay, when we come and talk on Thursday, that's one of the first things we're going to talk about. What's an exception to where you can have a protein, you can denature it, but then get it back to its original conformation? And I'll give you a hint. I'll give you a hint. It has to do with this bond right here. Some of you have undergone this process, and you've noticed a smell of sulfur in your room or from some part of your body. Okay, sulfur. Some of you might know what I'm talking about. It's a way of changing the shape of a protein and then changing it back. We'll talk about it on Thursday. Well, I don't want anybody to say right now. I want everybody to think. Sign-in sheet is going around somewhere. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet because that's your receipt that you're in class. I don't grade it?
No, you're fine.
Yep, the answer key will pop up in Blackboard, but I'll be happy to go over it with you. No, you don't turn it in for credit. Do it before lecture. That will help the most. Thank you. I'm going to turn off this microphone. The tests are multiple choice, labeling, true, false, maybe short answer. Oh, calculation sometimes with a calculator.
Like all of this, the diagram.
And exam figures are important. Yeah, exam figures are important.